I'd like to thank everybody for coming. This week we have the privilege of having Rabbi Avi Heller. Avi is the OU Regional Director of Synagogues for in New York and Rockland County. And prior to that, he was the Rav for the Manhattan Jewish Experience?
Director of Education.
Director of Education for Manhattan Jewish Experience. Yeah. Amongst many other things, I am sure, as we get to know Rabbi Heller, as he is recently moved to the shul 2-ish years ago, I think. And next week is Ovi Jacob, that's the rabbi's son-in-law. And then in August, we're going to take 2 weeks break, and then we're going to have younger rising stars, three individuals who are smicha, post-smicha program. One is Rabbi Sasson Gabay. He's the rabbinic intern at Beth Aaron. He's supposedly quite dynamic. Jonathan Ginsberg, who is in chinuch in the community in Davins here at times, so we grabbed him. And Yoshua Katz, who has spoken before, who was always very good.
What's the last name? Last person
you
mentioned?
Avi Katz. Okay, without further ado, Rabbi Heller.
Okay, thank you very much. It's my first time. You don't have to go easy on me, but it's nice to be here teaching, and this should be fun. We're going to talk. I changed it from 3 ways of viewing the Daughters of Tzlachat to 4 ways. Maybe there's more than 4. We'll see how it goes. A couple of just very brief introductory comments. The first one is, when we're talking about trying to understand who are these women, who are the Daughters of Tzlachat, we have 3 ways we can look at it. One is we can look at the psukim in front of us in the main story. The main story is in last week's Parsha and Pinchas, and then second half of it is at the end of the Parsha of Maaseh. So we can look at those psukim. We also have to think about other places where the story might be mentioned, and we'll look at a couple of those in Yoshua and Devar Hayamim. And then we have to consider the broader context. So in trying to figure out, without making assumptions, who do these women represent and how should we view them, we're going to look at those 3 things. The second introductory comment is the Torah and the rabbis love the Daughters of Tzlachat. It is one of the biggest love fests in the whole Tanakh. Like, there's almost no one they love more than them. They have nothing negative or even hesitant to say about them. They just love them. There are other women in Tanakh that Chazal love. Some of them are mentioned in close proximity here. Serach bat Asher and Yocheved and others. But they really love the Daughters of Tzlachat. So they're really, whoever they are, we're going to try to figure out how we can think about them. Whoever they are, we love them. So just saying that to start with. Now we're going to start by reading the psukim just to get into the story. So the main story is in Bamidbar, Perek Chav Zayin, Pasuk Aleph. It's only a few psukim. We're just going to go through it pretty quickly just to review the story for ourselves and then to see where it takes us. Are we good? Perek Chav Zayin, Pasuk Aleph. Okay. We start with a verb that has no... it's a transitive verb that doesn't have any object. Vatikravna b'not Tzlachat, the Daughters of Tzlachat drew close. It doesn't say to whom they drew close. Ben Chefer, Ben Gilad, Ben Bachir, Ben Menashe, Lemishbechot Menashe Ben Yosef. So it gives their whole genealogy. Ve'ela Shemot b'notav, and these are the names of his daughters. Machla, Noah, Fachagla, Umilka, V'tirza. There are 3 times in the Torah where it refers to the Daughters of Tzlachat, and it names all 5 of them. And this is fairly striking, to name all 5 of them and to put their names 3 times in the Torah, perhaps is a symbol of affection, saying it so many times. Because it doesn't need to say it, their names every time. It's almost ironic that the Torah mentions their names so frequently, and yet we call them the Bnei Tzlachat. We totally erase their names in the way in which we talk about them. But the Torah goes to such great lengths to mention their names over and over again. Vatamodna, and they stood lifnei Moshe, before Moshe, vilifnei Elazar HaKohen, vilifnei HaNisi'im. It's repeating this word lifnei a lot of times, which is sort of interesting. V'chol Eida, and the whole congregation, petach Oel Moed, at the entry to the Oel Moed, saying, Avinu meit bamibar, our father died in the desert. V'hulo aya betoch Eida, he was not among the congregation. Hanoadim al Hashem ba'adat Korach. He was not part of Korach. In other words, had he been the member of Korach, there would be nothing to talk about. They would be ineligible to inherit the land. That was part of the punishment of Adat Korach, is that none of their descendants could inherit the land. So they clearly say that he was not part of Adat Korach. It's a little strange that they would say it. You would think it would be known. Now, the particular sin of, the way the rabbis understand it, the particular sin of Adat Korach is that not only did they sin, but they caused others to sin. And this is as in Pirkei Avot, that sinning and causing others to sin is much worse than just sinning themselves, right? Ki bechet omet, he died of his own sin. In other words, the way Chazal understand it is that he sinned and he was killed for that sin, but he didn't cause others to sin. There is a very strange Gemara about this, in the Gemara that assumes that he is the Mekoshesh Eitzim, that he was the one who was killed for violating Shabbos. So in the Tosfos, he talks about it and says, Tosfos say that after the Mekoshesh Eitzim happened right after the punishment that they would have to wander in the desert. So there was a certain element of despondency and despair among the Jewish people. And it says that he did it L'Shem Shamayim, that he felt that people now, after they had been punished to wander in the desert for 40 years, would say, we're not going to keep halacha anymore. We don't have to keep Shabbos anymore. That's it. Well, now that we've been sentenced to die in the desert, we don't have to keep halacha anymore. So he went and was mechal Shabbos so that he would be arrested and killed to indicate to everyone else that the laws of Shabbos were still in effect. I don't even know what to do with that. It's like not a... That's a very extreme suicidal thing to do, and it's hard to take such a claim seriously that someone would do that, or that it would be a wise thing to do. But it's a way of looking at it that says not only did he not lead others into sin, but he specifically wanted to prevent others from going into sin. Okay, pasuk dalet, lama yigarash emavinu mitoch mishpachto. Why shall our father's name be eliminated from his family? Ki ein lo bein, just because he has no son. Tenalanu achuza, give us the land betoch achei avinu, among our uncles. Vayakrev Moshe mishpatan lifnei Hashem. Moshe brings their claim before Hashem. It is strange that Moshe does not know the answer. It's one of approximately six cases where Moshe seems not to know the halacha. And we'll talk about that a little bit more a little bit later. But he doesn't seem to know, or at least he doesn't give them an answer. The daughters of Slavchat spoke correctly. Give them the achuzah, is what they asked for, but here it calls it an achuzat nachala. And then it goes on and describes all of the halachot of inheritance, and those are discussed at great length in Baba Basra. So we're going to stop there with that story. That's the basic line of the story. The only thing is, there is an appendix to the story that happens at the end of our parsha, which is that their other tribesmen come to Moshe at the end of Maaseh, and they say, if the daughters of Tzlafchad get married to men from other tribes, we will lose our inheritance. The tribe of Menashe will lose its inheritance. Now, there are two strange things. And so Moshe tells them that they should marry within the tribe. There is a discussion as to whether or not he commands them, which is what it sounds like in the Torah, or whether he simply gives them an Eitzah Tova. The rabbis say it's an Eitzah Tova. And they choose to do so, and they marry within their family. They marry their cousins. And therefore, they don't lose anything. There are a few strange things about this. Number one is they waited a very long time to get married, which is discussed. If it's true that their father was the Mekoshesh Eitzim, then they're fairly old. Forgetting the I don't know what the single standards were like in the time of the desert, but they would certainly have been in their 40s or 50s or older. So they waited a very long time to get married. And so that is one strange thing. The other strange thing is, happens to be, and I want to think about this some more, that the tribal holdings of Manasseh were vast. They were really, really big, geographically bigger than any other tribe. And it is strange that they were so concerned about what would seem to be a really small piece of their territory. But I don't know. In any case, the daughters of Tzelophehad do what they're asked to do, and they keep it in the tribe. And we're going to talk a little bit later about why that only applied for that generation, and afterwards everybody was allowed to marry into other tribes, but in that generation they did not. Okay, so I identified four approaches to how we can look at the Bnei Tzelophehad. It's really six, but we'll call it four for now, and maybe we'll come up with more as we go. And I want to go in a certain order. We'll see how deep we can go into it and how much time we have. The first way that I would look at it is to think of the daughters of Tzelophehad as members of the tribe of Manasseh. That this is who they are and what they represent. And it makes a lot of sense based on the idea that the end of the story is really all about them marrying so that the land stays in the tribe. On the other hand, it wouldn't really matter if their father kept the land or not. If the land just reverted back up the inheritance chain, instead of going to them, it would just go up to their uncles or to their great uncles. So it would still be in the tribe. But the context of Manasseh seems to be important to the story. So take a look at Bamidbar Chaf Vav, Pasuk Chaf Tet, which is the genealogy of Manasseh that's in Pinchas. And it is unique among all the tribes. Most of the tribes, only two or three generations of genealogy are discussed. Here, what we'll see is as follows. B'nai Manasseh, so we from Yosef, we have Manasseh, Machir, then Gilad. After Gilad, we get a whole bunch of brothers: Eezer, Chelek, Asriel, Shechem, Shmida, Chefer. That's four. Then Tzlaf. No, grandfather. Hold on, did I skip one?
No, I'm just saying. Aren't they Tzlaf and
Chefer? Hold on. So it's Yosef, Manasseh. Oh yeah, Yosef, Manasseh, Machir, Gilad, Chefer, Tzelophehad, and then the daughters of Tzelophehad. So there's seven generations, or six are mentioned here, but from the time of the tribe, you have seven generations mentioned here. None of the other tribes are even close to mention that many, and there is something potentially symbolically important about the fact that the Bnei Tzelophehad are the seventh generation, and that they're mentioned here as the seventh generation. It may indicate a certain kind of, again, like a kind of a chibah. Often in genealogies, the seventh generation is considered important. We see that a lot in Bereishit. However, the idea that there is something special going on in the tribe of Manasseh is very possible. And it could be that what they represent as far as making a claim for an inheritance in the land, that they're doing so as members of the tribe of Manasseh. Now, there is something else that's very strange about the tribe of Manasseh. And that is that they are fit together with the Bnei Reuven and the Bnei Gad, but they don't belong with them. So in our parsha, we have a whole story of the Bnei Reuven and the Bnei Gad petitioning Moshe that they should have land in the Transjordan. Instead of going into the land of Israel, they should be given an achuzah outside of the land of Israel. And in all the times that it's mentioned, I think there are five times that the conversation is going between Moshe and the tribes. It's always talked about the Bnei Reuven and the Bnei Gad. And it's only at the very, very end of the story, which is just find it here. I went too far. We'll get it afterwards. Only at the very end of the story that the Chatzi Shevet HaMenashe is added in. Only when it says Vayitein El Moshe, or Moshe, that Moshe gives them the land, does it mention that the Chatzi Shevet HaMenashe is with them. So they're not part of the whole conversation, but at the same time, half of the tribe of Menashe suddenly splits off, which is unique among all the other tribes, and they have half of their tribe across the Jordan and half inside of Eretz Yisrael. How and why this happened seems strange, and we don't even know why it happened. There's one brief discussion of it in the Yerushalmi. It's source number 5 on page 2. In the Yerushalmi in Bikurim, it's talking about whether or not you can bring Bikurim from Transjordan. And it brings two opinions as to why you would do it. One opinion suggests that it's based on the pasuk of Eretz Zavat Chalav Udvash. Is Transjordan considered to be part of the land flowing with milk and honey? And the other one is based on a pasuk, Asher Natatali. Is Transjordan considered to be part of the land that Hashem gave to the Jewish people? And the Gemara suggests that the difference, the machlokas between them, is really just the bolded words on the second line from the bottom, is Chasi Shevet HaMenashe Lo Natlume Atzman. That they did not, in other words, they were not part of the acquisition of the Bnei Reuven and Bnei Gad. Whereas Bnei Reuven and Bnei Gad took that, claimed that territory for themselves, selected it and chose it, that it's not true of the Chatzi Shevet HaMenashe. They didn't take it themselves. If they didn't take it themselves, how did they get it? So this brings a possibility for something that is a very strange possibility. In Divrei HaYamim, we have a discussion in source number 3 that it says, V'achar b'chetzron el bat machir avi gilad v'hu l'kacha v'hu ben shishim shana v'atelet lo et skuv u'skuv holid et ya'ir, and skuv gave birth to ya'ir. Vahilo esrim v'shalosh arim be'eretz ha-gilad, and he had 23 cities in the land of Gilad. These are what we call Chavot Ya'ir, which are discussed at the end of, were discussed in Bamidbar as well.
This is Chetzro from tribe of Yehuda.
So the question is, Chetzro from Yehuda. So that's problem number one, which I wasn't going to get into. The question is, when were these conquests made? In the Torah, it sounds like the conquests were made in the desert, at the same time as Chavot Ya'ir were conquered and Novach. It sounds like these conquests were made while the Jewish people were in the desert. However, the chronology, if it's true that it's Machir ben Menashe, does not work. Machir ben Menashe would have had to have been very, very old. Now, there is such a suggestion in the Seder Olam Rabbah that Machir was among those who came to Mitzrayim and among those who left Mitzrayim. But he would have had to be fantastically old, like 250 years old. So it's a very strange possibility. Instead, there is a... that he was in Mitzrayim. So not he didn't go down to Mitzrayim, but he was in Mitzrayim. In fact, it's actually one of the things, we'll talk about it in a second, but one of the special things about both Ephraim and Menashe is that they never went down to Mitzrayim, so they never lived in Canaan. They never experienced living in Canaan. And I think that's important to the psychology of being in Menashe, but let's hold off for one second. There is a Sefer, and I had never heard of this before, but he's called the Talmid HaRasag. Talmid HaRasag, a student of Rav Sadia Gaon. We don't know if he's a true student of Rav Sadia Gaon, but he mentions him. And he interprets this pasuk as saying that the tribe of Menashe conquered the land of Bashan and the land of the Amori before the Jews were enslaved in Egypt, during the time of Yosef. Yosef was the viceroy. Menashe was his son, he was part of the aristocracy, and that the timeline would work that at that time they conquered this land in Transjordan and they held it during Yosef's time, and then later on when they became enslaved and Yosef was dead and they were no longer in power in Egypt, so other nations came and took it back, but that it had originally been conquered, settled, and claimed by Menashe all the way back in the time of Yosef. And there are, we don't, I think, have the time to go through it, but there are a number of hints in Divrei HaYamim that this would be true, and that there was a connection to this area right over the Jordan River to the tribe of Menashe all the way back to the time of Yosef. For this reason, it seems like the tribe of Menashe had a family tradition or a sort of a emotional attachment to this area. But it wasn't as if when they arrived at Israel that they said, oh, we don't want to go in. And that was what was so upsetting to Moshe. He said, you're just like the Miraglim. You know, you don't want to, you're going to make everyone feel like Israel's not important. You're going to make them feel like we can't do it by trying to claim this land on the other side of the Jordan. But he never says that to Hatzishev al-Menashe. And the suggestion is that because there was an age-old attachment to this land, that they had already conquered it once upon a time, that they had a family history that had already belonged to them, they simply reacquired it. Sorry?
Well, that's why they were happy, because the only thing that said is that they had lots of cattle. That's why they wanted the land. But that didn't refer to Menashe.
No, that's just B'nai Reuven and B'nai Gad. So B'nai Reuven and B'nai Gad, for their own personal reasons.
The answer why Menashe was added, that you know, there's a Medrash that says that they were added because they were very attached to Torah. They wanted to have somebody on the other side of the Jordan that was more religious.
Okay, so that is a different approach. I've heard that before, and it's a different approach. This approach suggests that they had a particular attachment to this area of land that went way back in their history. So when they came back, they wanted at least part of the tribe to live there. Now, if that's true, and it's certainly the opinion of the Talmid HaRasag, and it is borne out by some evidence in Divrei HaYamim, if it's true, then what we see about the tribe of Menashe is that they had a particular attachment to land in general. As a part of their tribal tradition, they felt that they were returning home, even though Menashe had never lived in Canaan, that they were people that loved the land and that were passionate about going to Israel.
There's also traditions that Ephraim settled the area of Shem way back when.
Correct. So I'm just afraid that I'm going to take too much time on this particular approach. I just want to say one more thing about this as a sort of adjunct to this. So what I'm suggesting is that we should view Benot Slavchad in the context of the story here potentially as members of the tribe of Menashe who had a special attachment to the land of Israel. Now it could be, and I amended it on page 2 as approach 1A, that when I say they're members of the tribe of Menashe, what I mean is they're lovers of the land, that they love the land of Israel. And this, in fact, is how Rashi views them. Rashi, we'll come back to this, never identifies their particular claim as a feminine claim or a woman's claim. He does identify them as lovers of the land. This is what Rashi says in source 4. Lama Nemar, why does it say Lamishbechot Menashe ben Yosef? Valo Kfar Nemar ben Menashe. Ela Lomar Lecha Yosef Chibeve Ta'aretz. Just like Yosef loved the land, so too they loved the land. So the identity of the Benot Slavchad are people who feel especially passionate about the land of Israel and about having a share in the land of Israel, and that what explains their need to petition Moshe to make sure that their family and their tribe continues to have this land is a long-standing aspect of the tribe of Menashe. That's approach number one. Okay. I also just point out briefly, I have here source number 6. There's a long discussion in Bamidbar Chaf Aleph about the Jewish people dwelling in the land of the Amorites. And it uses the language of Ayeshev. And I'm really bothered by this because we know they didn't spend a lot of time there. They, on their way to the land of Israel, in the 40th year, they stopped and conquered Sichon, and they conquered Og Melech HaBashan. But to say, Vayeshev Yisrael Be'eretz HaEmori, or as it says a number of times there, that they settled all of their cities, seems like a very strange thing. And perhaps it relates back to the other history, because the people who were conquering that land, it's unclear who they were. The Torah describes them as Meraglim, that Moshe sends, but we know also that it was members of the tribe of Manasseh that were involved in that conquering. So I'm not exactly sure when it happened or how it happened, but it may be related to this story as well. Okay, approach number two is that the way we should look at the Benot Slavchad is that they are caring children, that they care about their family. And in their own words, it seems to be the most likely scenario, because what they say about what they want is Lama Yigara Shema Vinu Mitoch Mishpachto. What they say they care about is their father's name and and his family. They don't describe it as our family, they describe it as his family. So it seems like they care very much about their father and their father's legacy. So we should look at them as caring about that, and not about their own particular claim. Meaning, they may say, Tina lanu achuza, give us the land, but it's not because we deserve the land, or we want the land, or we want to be like the boys are, any of those things. What we want is to safeguard our father's legacy. The idea of shame is found in a number of places. There is a midrash that talks about the idea that when they interrupted Moshe to ask him to adjudicate their claim, that he was in the middle of darshaning the idea, he was darshaning the sugya of Yabam, that's the halachic discourse he was giving at that time was about levirate marriage, and then they came and asked him this question. And it happens to be that the significance of that is the whole point of Yibum is that the name, as it says in source number 8, that the lo yimachesh shemo Yisrael, that the brother who died without any children, that his name should remain in Israel. And the same thing, we find this, the same thing that Boaz talks about when he marries Rut, is that he doesn't want v'lo yikaret shem hamet me'imechav, that he doesn't want the name. Now, each time it uses a slightly different verb. So we have yimacheh, which is like wiping out, versus yikaret, which is cutting off, versus yigara, which means to somehow detract or erase. So each one is a slightly different verb, but the concept here is that what they are concerned about is making sure that the shame of their father is preserved. So I brought one other source related to this idea, which is Gemara in Shabbat, which is asking the question of what sin did Slavchad commit. So it says, Tanu Rabbanan, Mekoshesh zet Slavchad, the gatherer of wood was Slavchad, V'cheinu omer, V'ayu b'nei Yisrael b'amibar, V'ayimtzu'u ish, so it says he's an ish, U'lahalan amar, Avinu meit b'amibar, Ma'lahalan Slavchad, Avkan Slavchad. Divrei Rabbi Akiva, that's Rabbi Akiva's opinion, is that the sin was the Mekoshesh etzim. Amar lo Rabbi Yehuda ben Beteira, and that the Mekoshesh etzim is the most popular explanation. Everybody likes Rabbi Akiva's explanation. You rarely hear Rabbi Yehuda ben Beteira who says to Akiva, ben kach uben kach ata atid litena tadin. He says, Akiva, you are in trouble no matter how you slice it. Im kidvaracha, if it's like what you say, HaTorah kisato ve'ata migaleoto, the Torah specifically didn't want to embarrass this person and say who he was, and you revealed it, like you're telling secrets that you're not supposed to tell. V'imlav, and if not, atamoti lazal oto tzadik, then Tzavchad was a tzadik, and you're calling him a rasha. So he says, however you slice it, Akiva is doing the wrong thing. He doesn't actually say that he's wrong. There are other opinions that Tzavchad was among the Mapilim, that he was simply one of the people who was sentenced to die after the Meraglim, which would make sense because everybody should be in that category except for Kalev and Yoshua. Ibn Ezra says strangely that he didn't commit a sin at all. That it's simply saying that he was part of, it was almost like saying the fact that he wasn't righteous enough to make it to the land of Israel to be exempted from the sin of the Meraglim is almost saying in a not saying specifically that he committed a sin, but saying like, oh, like bavo nesenu harabim, we things are not as great as they could be. Like they were just saying in general, like, oh, you know, because because he wasn't as righteous as he could have been, he's not here with us today. So I mention this only because there's a sensitivity here, despite the fact that he's not being very sensitive to Rabbi Akiva, there's a sensitivity to the privacy and the reputation of Tzlafchad. Yehuda ben Beter is very concerned about Tzlafchad being maligned. He thinks he's a tzaddik. And so I mention it only because there's this sensitivity for his daughters as well, that they wanted his memory to be remembered latov. Okay. Approach number three is that we should view the Benot Tzlafchad as righteous leaders, as paradigms of what we would want from lay leadership in Klal Yisrael. That everything they do, they are a case study in how to create change in a positive way. And everything they do is positive. They are, first of all, united. There's not one, it's not one daughter who goes and speaks or you know, is all by herself. They come together. There's actually a midrash that says that there are five clauses in their statement and that each daughter said one, right? So the first daughter said, Avinu Meit Bamibar, and the second one said, V'hu lo hayabada Korach, and the third one said, Gibchet Omeit, and then each one said one of the clauses. So they were perfectly united in the way they spoke. They were courageous. They were, you know, they went and stood up and went into the Beit Midrash as five women and spoke in front of all the men in the Eidah. They were respectful. They were well organized and well spoken. Rav Hirsch, in his commentary, writes about how lean and articulate their argument is. There's not a wasted word in their argument. Every word in their argument is conveying a part of the message, and there's nothing extra, and there's nothing that doesn't have to be there. And the Gemara in Bava Batra says that they were chachmaniot, which is interpreted as they had derech eretz. They were darshaniot, meaning they knew how to interpret the Torah in order to derive the halacha from it. And they were tzadkariot, that they were machmir on themselves related to how they would conduct themselves until they had an answer. So they are, in many ways, just an example of all the things that you would want to do if you wanted to create change. And they do not foment rebellion. They do not start social media campaigns. They do not figure that you have to break a couple of eggs in order to make progress in this world. They don't do any of those things. They are resolute and courageous, but not caustic in any way. And all of this is, I think, an amazing reason to love them, and also an amazing, you know, example, a study of how we might want to think about creating change. We certainly know that there are changes that we need to see in this world and in our religious communities, but a lot of times we, taking a playbook out of, I guess, 21st century America, feel that that it can't be done this way, that being too polite is not a way to get anything done. I don't know. Maybe that's sometimes true, but they certainly got a lot accomplished by doing it this way. In looking at them this way, I am being very dafka about not viewing them as role models for women or women's role models. I think they're just role models. And in fact, in every approach that we've taken so far, I think that, I don't want to say it's irrelevant that they are women, because I don't think that, but I think that the context or the way in which we view them so far is not necessary to identify them specifically as women. They can easily be members of the tribe of Menashe without referring to their gender. They can easily be concerned children, whether they are sons or daughters, and they can easily be righteous leaders and role models to us, whether they're men or women. So I specifically chose the first three approaches to talk about them in a gender-neutral way. The final approach, or the final way we have to think about it, is: are they? Should we specifically view them as women? And as a corollary to that, should we view them as feminists? Or, if you want to be, you know, dafka about it, since feminism was only the word was only introduced in the 1890s or later than that, proto-feminists. And in a way, it's hard to say that. To say that they're not. They're specifically dealing with a women's case. It's specifically about daughters inheritance of the land, and it is, they are the ones who have to do it. There are no men who take up their case. Nobody from the tribe of Manasseh, not the head of Manasseh. Nobody else takes up their claim to do it for them. So they are in a position where they have to do it themselves. So it's hard not to say that it is a women's story, and that we should view them in through the prism of saying that this is kind of a proto-feminism. So Rav Samet argues strongly against this, because he feels strongly that the approach, Rav Elchanan Samet argues strongly against this, because he says that it's clear that the main thing they were interested in was their father, and that that's not a feminist cause. That Kiburav is not a feminist cause, and if they're mostly interested in their father's legacy, has nothing to do with women's rights. That's what he argues. I don't know if I agree with it being that black and white. I do think that there are plenty of places in Chazal where they identify them specifically as women, and I brought two examples. One example is a very strange midrash in Bamidbar Rava, which I don't really understand. Maybe we'll figure it out. So it says, "Vatikravna benot slavcha." I'm on source 13, the last page. "Vatikravna benot slavcha." Oto hador hayu hanashim godrot masha nashim portzim. Now that is a kind of a feminist statement, certainly a combative statement. Everything that the men broke in that generation, the women fixed. Okay. Shekenat motzei she'amar lahen Aaron, parkuniz mezahav shebeznei nishechem. Aaron told them, go get the nose rings from your wives to build the golden calf. V'loratzu anashim, and the women didn't want to give it to them. Umichu bebalehen, and they said, we're not going to give you our jewelry. So we have such a tradition that the women were not part of the sin of the Egel Hazav. Okay, the anashim lo nishtafu imam b'masai Egel. L'chei b'meraglim. And also with the Meraglim, Shotziu Diba, Vayashuvu Vayalinu Alav Eskola Eda Vayaleim Nigzura Gzeira She'amrun Lo Nuchal La'alot. When the people said, we cannot go up to the land of Israel. Aval Anashim Lo Ayu Imahem Be'etza. But the women of Klal Yisrael were not part of that negativity and that pessimism of Lo Nuchal La'alot. Because it says, Ki Amar Hashem Lahem Mot Yamutu Bamibar V'lo Notar Mehem Ish. Not one man among them was left of all of the generation of the desert. Ki'im Kalev ben Yefuneh, except for Kalev and Yoshua. Ish velo isha. In other words, says the Midrash, the women were not subject to the onesh of the Meitei Midbar. Aval hanashim karvu levakesh nachala ba'aretz. But what the women did do is they drew close in order to request that they have an opportunity to have a part in the land. So we wrote the Benot Slavcha close to the time when the last people in the desert died, which was on Tisha B'Av, probably, right? Shemisham partzu ha'anashim v'gadru ha'anashim. The men messed it up and the women fixed it. So this is clearly a strong anti-man midrash and pro-women's midrash, but I cannot understand it. Is it possible to argue that the women of the generation of the desert didn't die, that only the men died? Hayitachem? Say that? Of course then some of the women must have died. Maybe what we're arguing is that, there's a midrash that on Tisha B'Av night, the Gemara says that on Tisha B'Av night everybody had to dig their own graves and lie in them, and in the morning only some of them would get out, and then they would bury the ones who didn't. That's what Tisha B'Av was like in the desert. That's a little more dramatic than our Tisha B'Av. So perhaps the women were not subject to that requirement. Maybe that was something only the men had to do. I don't know. But it's very strange. But it certainly it puts the Benot Slavcha here into the context of saying they are part of the righteousness of the Jewish women in the desert. Okay. The other midrash, which is very striking on this topic, is from the Yaakov Shimoni. It's quoted in a few other places. It says, "Kevan sherau benot slavcha cha'aretz nitchalka lizcharim velo lanekevot." When the benot slavcha saw that the land was being divided up for men and not for women, Nitkaptu kulam zuazul lito etza. They got together to decide what to do. Amru lo rachme basar v'adam perachme amakom. The way in which human beings are disposed emotionally is not the way that Hashem is. Rachame basar v'adam rachamav al zechar miyotar manakevot. We know that in culture, in society, people are going to discriminate against women. Okay, can you imagine? Aval misha amar v'haya ha'olam, but Hashem eino kein. Hashem would never discriminate against women. Rachamav al zechar v'al manakevot. He would be equally compassionate to men and to women. Okay, so here we also have a depiction of them as representing women. Sorry? A little later, it is, I think, generally considered one of the later Midrashim. I don't remember the exact, what they say exactly when it was closed.
The issue of marrying their cousins.
Yeah.
So how is it possible this was tied to tribalism that existed very strongly?
So I think my suspicion is that tribalism has both positive and negative aspects. On the one hand, it creates a certain sense of pride in your tribe, and the tribes had to do things together, like conquer their section, which was what went wrong at the end of Yoshua when the tribes were not equally doing what they needed to do. And by the way, Menashe was not one of them. Menashe did conquer their section. But then if you get too much separation between the tribes, if they become like political parties and there's no marriage between them, it becomes very negative. So there is a really interesting Gemara, thank you for reminding me, I think I brought it here, about this. Yes, source number 11. It's a really fascinating Gemara. Take a look real quickly. Tanan Hasan, Amar Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, Lo hayu yamim tovim li Yisrael, ka chamisha asar ba'av v'chiyom ha-kipurim. The two biggest Yom Tovs in the Jewish calendar was Yom Kippur and Tu B'Av. Okay? Shebahem b'not Yerushalayim yotzot b'klei lavan she'ulin shelo levayish es mi she'ein lo. Okay? So, now, here's what it says. Bishlama Yom HaKippurim. Oh, I understand that the women would go out in white dresses and dance on Yom Kippur. It's not what we do. Yom Slicha u'mechila, but the idea of whiteness and atonement, that makes sense to me. Yom Shenitnu Bo Luchot Achronot, the second Luchot were given on that day. Ela Chamisha Asar Ba'av, my he. But what's so special about Tu Ba'av? So the Gemara gives six answers, but the first one that it gives here is instructive. Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel, Yom Shehutru Shvatim Lavoze Bazeh. The generation after the Benot Slavchad, they made a big announcement and were Matir Asurim and said, any Shvatim that want to intermarry, if the girls of Menashe want to marry other men, they should be welcome to do it. And apparently, the context of it sounds like there were problems between the Shvatim, that there was tension and strife. Either some people wanted to marry other people and they weren't being allowed to by authority structures, or there was fighting between the tribes. Something was not right here. So when they were matir, everybody to marry, it became like a Yom Tov. It was actually a really, really positive development for the Jewish people to allow the integration of the tribes. So it sounds to me like the tribalism got excessive over time, so the generation after the Benot Slavchad, they had to loosen their bonds. Did that answer what you're looking for? Okay.
So that was the one day.
Yeah.
That day,
Tu B'Av, which we still kind of celebrate, not really. I mean, we don't see Tachna. Some people have parties with white dresses. I don't know. At least they do in Manhattan. But it was, I think, at one point a much bigger celebration. There are other reasons for Tu B'Av, maybe related to those two. How much time do we have left? We're done.
Yeah, try to stop.
Okay, so I'm going to stop in 30 seconds. I'm just going to say I did want to, I very consciously wanted to look at the Benot Slavchad as paragons of women, but also to look at them in another way. Regarding this question of whether or not they are proto-feminists, which is a really interesting question, and there's a lot of stuff out there about it, I just put four questions to think about as to whether or not they would fit into that category or not, and they are interesting questions to ask before reaching conclusions. Thank you all for learning with me, and have a great night.
Thank you very much.
We're good.
Shkol to you. Thank you.